All right, so how's the mic?
Closer.
Closer. Now is that better? I would like to move it up, but it does stand. I was going to get Viagra for it, but now how's the mic? All right? So first thing you need to know is whoever wrote the bio was not me, or it was written a long time ago, because people who have had suicide do not say committed suicide anymore. Okay? That is verboten. So now your PC, you remember that. You say he took his life. I say he killed himself. The shock value is spectacular. But you don't say committed. That's a crime. I feel like I'm really loud. Am I really too loud?
No, you're perfect.
I'm perfect. Right. Second thing you should know about me is in my teaching career, the more frustrated and upset I get, the more I swear. So you will be able to have this kind of meter to know where I'm at any given moment. Now, do you remember a year ago, there was that substitute teacher who got in trouble and was banned from teaching in a particular school because she said condom and boob? That's me. So, that's me. Yeah, if I remember.
I should have put that in your bio.
You could have. And I think what precipitated the big thing was I had told the class, I saw some kids chewing, and I said, I was trying to keep their attention as a sub. It's a tough thing. I said, oh, you're masticating. Well, you know, you say that to high school kids, and they kind of lose it. And even though I went through and explained what mastication was, I don't think they heard anything after the first of that. So, now, I don't know how many of you are here because you have lost a child. And I don't know how many of you who have lost a child had people say to you, no parent should have to bury their child, which is a lovely thing to hear, except ever since Eve, it's been done. And I remember when I was 14 reading David, whose Absalom's son was not his, you know, stellar, stalwart child, crying, my son, Absalom, my son. And I remember just aching. And I remember learning about my grandparents and my parents before them, how all of them had lost a child. And so long before this, I don't know whether I was being prepared or not, but, and it's actually been 6 years now, I was crying, my son Brian, would to God I would have taken your place, my son. Now, you need to know I take antidepressants. With depression and PMS and endometriosis, I was not a pretty person. I'm still not. But it probably saved my life, and it definitely saved my marriage. And there would be many times I'd be so angry. You pick a person. God was usually one of them, and Keith, my husband, was the next. That I was so angry, why am I sticking around? And I would get in my truck, and I'm going to go kill myself. And now I would never hurt my truck. You have to understand that. I would not hurt my truck. But, and I know I'd made sure I would not do a half-assed job. I was going to do it. I'm going to do it right. And so there's rationality in my irrationality, but it allowed me time to think and calm down and come back home. So we adopted Brian when he was 3. He had spent we don't know what happened to him in his first 2 years. He was 6 months in the orphanage when this picture was taken, and then 6 months in a foster family in Korea, and then he came to us. He joined his younger sister, a product of Clomid and lots of other wonderful homemade processes. So I've always said I had two homemade children and one store-bought child, that's Brian, and then I had a couple of rented children. They were my foster children. And once a church member was seen Lena and Brian playing outside, and she said, "Is he adopted?" I'm thinking, "No shit, Sherlock." Yes, I said. She said, "Does he know he's adopted?" Yes, he knows he's adopted. And then she said, "What does he call you?" Now, I really wanted to say Mama Son and Papa Son, but I played nice. I did. And I just tried to avoid her in the ward after that. Brian was a normal kid, and having been a high school teacher, I knew he was better than most. He was damn good. He was bright. He was affectionate. He was always my son. He was my solar son besides my son. And he was gregarious. He knew everybody, including the police. That worried me some, that he would know all of the police on the force. He was drop-dead handsome. That's him with my first granddaughter. Loved the children. And as with Hamilton, he had a way with the ladies. He really was a marvelous person. He served an LDS mission. He was called to Chicago. The first half, he was with a mission president who was fairly decent. And the second half, he was with an ex-military, you do it my way. And if you notice, Brian is flipping off the camera person. Now, I'm guessing that's his companion, but Brian's got his middle finger up there because he didn't want his picture taken while he was personal with the Emesis Basin. But also, that mission president, Brian was in a bike accident with a car, and the mission president would not let him call home, so Brian did. You see, a parent fail is we raised our kids to think for themselves. And I should have said, except if you're on a mission. If you're on a mission, you know thinky. Because Brian had a real hard time with that. He came home and I got some harassment from a bishop. Well, actually, Brian always had safe sex, okay? At the age of 15, and the other two girls were 13 and 11, I gave them, "Thou shalt use condoms if you are going to have sex." I'm not a normal mother either. Another parent fail. But anyway, the bishop really harassed Brian about this a grievous sin that he'd done, and Brian didn't give a care. So Brian took off his garments and had quit going to church and followed his own path. My husband, because I mentioned, my husband didn't see Brian as my husband remembered himself. Perfect. And so Brian felt that he was rejected by a biological father, he's rejected by an adoptive father, and now he's rejected by a heavenly father. By the way, my husband has seen the light and has left the church also, so we're okay. Brian had serious girlfriends. He had one where he was a stabilizing father figure to two little girls. He was the wage earner. I don't know a lot of what happened because he wouldn't talk about it, but that girl left, and it took a part of Brian with him, and he said, I'll never marry. I'll never get serious again. I was with him one time at a store, and the clerk, that Brian had frequented this place a lot, the clerk said, "Well, are you married?" And he said, "No." She said, "But you're so nice and kind." That's what I would always hear from people, is he was kind. And she said, "Why aren't you, you are so
So good.
And he says, because I'm not married. So he did meet another woman, and they had a long relationship. They bought a house together. I don't know what happened. I don't know. There's no blame. I'll never know. Now, I have to backtrack. For 20 years, I've taken my students, biology teacher, to Catalina Island. I didn't that year. It was a beautiful day in April, and daffodils were full bloom. I just had the carpets cleaned. It was spring break. Grass smelled wonderful, and a police came to my door. The dog's in the backyard. What's going on? I even mentally checked my daughters. My daughters, you know, because they've got depression issues. And he said, I regret to inform you that your son has taken his life. Now, I kept asking, is he sure? Was he sure? Because, see, Brian was not the one who would do that. He had counseled many families of other friends who had taken their lives. Brian was a rock. Brian was the designated driver, the steady one, the sure one. He was the emotional support for all of us. But in the middle of the fight with his girlfriend, he got in the truck and locked the door, reached under the cab and pulled out his Glock and shot himself twice in the heart. Not my Brian. Not Brian. And so those two shots tore through me. And, you know, you're walking around with this flipping bowling ball hole in your heart. Chest, and you have to tell. You tell everybody you're extremely inappropriate. I'm at the Costco line getting pictures for the funeral. My son took his life, and people are in the Costco line with their extra eggs, going. But he did. I was so emotionally wrecked. I could only do puzzles for the first week, and the second week. I was so full of anger for myself. And I certainly wasn't going to have the bishop or anybody do a Boyd K. Service. They were not going to take that young man's death and change it into a plan of salvation. And I let them know, and the poor bishop, who was a friend of Brian's growing up, is open mouth. I was a bitch. I was a bitch to the Relief Society president. I didn't care. I still had to be nice with the girlfriend, because I don't know. There were a few insensitive people, one related by marriage, who saw us 2 years after and said, you know, I never called or sent a card because I didn't know what to say. And my husband hugged her, and I just stared. You know, there are things you can say, even if it's a store-bought card and sign your name, at least acknowledge them. And then a week after Brian's funeral, his other sister came and was chatting on the phone. My husband was still asleep. Oh, and we want you to go with us to visit our sick cousin, blah, 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 you know, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't acknowledge, and I said, it's been a week since I buried my son. I don't want to do anything. And she goes, I'm sorry. You know, it's okay. Just back away from me. Stay far away. I let people know I would cold cock them if they ever said that what Brian did was a selfish act. I firmly believe that if you look at it through my jaded, stupid eyes, Jesus took his life because he could have saved himself, says so in the scriptures. He could have called the angels down. And he basically said, it's enough, and gave up the spirit. And I think when a person is in so much pain, and I've been there, when they are in so much pain, that it is enough. And we can't judge him. And yeah, it's been tough, but I'll never be angry with Brian. I've grieved. I grieve for his biological mother. I feel like such a failure to her. But I never see him as a shortcoming or or a failure. We were able to donate a lot of his parts to the international donor, Intermountain Donor Foundation, which is a wonderful thing. They give you a lot of support. It's just you need to know that you're going to be on that flipping phone for an hour saying, yes, I know, yes, I know, yes, I do. It's an hour, and you know it's legality, but if the man has said donor on his driver's license, you don't need to talk to anybody. Just take the damn organs and get over with it. Sorry, I'm getting excited. I'm stressed. School was tough. I went back to school, and yet it wasn't. I couldn't leave my room. My students were my angels. They protected me. They would write me little notes. If I needed to go anywhere outside my room, they made sure that they did it for me because I couldn't face the world. I couldn't see the world. And then a year later, I encountered Sister Perky. Sister Perky's the one in Relief Society who gives you the talk that we will be grateful for all of our hardships, and we will thank God for every one of our trials. May I tell you, that's a bunch of crap. Because I got up and started to leave, and I hear one sister say, oh, she should stay. This will help her. And I left, because I'm going to do the ugly cry. And another sister follows me out. What's the matter? You shitting me? But I don't say that. But it's run through my head. I will never be grateful that my son took his life. I will never. And so when I was the piano chorister for Relief Society, I would go to play the opening for her, and then I would leave and then come back for the closing. The whole ward knew that I wouldn't sit in Sister Perky's lessons. My son never suffered fools. If you were a dick, if you were a prick, he let you know. And I don't put myself in harm's way anymore. How do I cope? How did I cope then? One of the things I did is I did massages every 2 weeks. And I went to different people, but I would tell them the story and cry while they worked all the muscles and the pain out. I wear his bracelet. I wear the locket. My niece gave me this rock because Rock Brian was my rock, and there's a son here. I wear these all the time. They help. 3 years ago, I tattooed Brian's Korean name over my heart. It was interesting how many people in the tattoo studio could sense what was going on. I didn't say anything at that time. And one young man stepped up and gave me a great big hug, smelling of Brian's tobacco smoke. Said, just want you to know he loves you. Yeah, he did. They would tell me, his girlfriend said, he was a mama's boy. But not in a bad way. But he loved his mama. And boy, I loved him. If you ever have to do this, a couple of hints. Make sure you get 10 to 15 death certificates. You're going to need that many death certificates. If you can't sleep, because you won't, take Benadryl. It's better than the other stuff the doctors recommended. Shortly after Brian's death, I had several nightmares that my granddaughter had taken her life. And last year, Sarah threatened at least 4 times, and one time really serious, to take her life. It was pretty tough for my daughter and me. And Sarah was gay. She comes out as lesbian. Well, it makes a lot of sense. But do you know when this started? When the suicide threat started? Yep, November policy. That was it. I look at people with living sons that are Brian's age, and I wonder, what would it be like? What would it be like to have a son that's living? Does my doctor's mom know that? Does my audiologist's mom know that? What did they know? I don't know. But I don't have any more to say. And I'm doing the ugly cry. And I thank you for listening.
I I've been in touch with our third presenter, but he hasn't showed yet. He did have to travel quite a distance, so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Or go on to a question part of our presentation. But I wanted to ask Doe a couple of questions first. Okay, how's that? So our third presenter hasn't shown yet, but he had to travel quite a distance, even though I'd been in touch with him. But I wanted to ask you a couple of questions first before I turn it over to the audience. I know I talked to you a couple of times when you were in the really angry stage, and I've learned from personal experience the best thing to do is just listen. Don't make any trite statements. Don't give any gospel advice. Don't say anything about, well, because you believe this, it will be easier, because it's never easier. It's never easier, no matter what you believe, no matter what you don't believe. It just doesn't matter. And I remember when I discussed this with you, when you were in a more difficult spot, and I wanted to know if you wanted to share anything about those difficult spots, and even though those difficult spots are going to recur for the rest of your life, what you kind of used or what they felt like, if you'd like to share that with us.
I'll be really honest, I'm not sure that I remember what we talked about. Can you, like, give me some hints?
Well, you just,
what did I say?
You just talked about your pain. Just your pain and your loss and your grief and your confusion about religion at the time. And
Yeah. I mean, I, like, my what I filled in is that I'm a pagan Mormon. I used to call myself a Mormon pagan, but now I've just dropped the Mormon. I'm pagan. I mean, literally. I follow an earth-centered path, earth-based path. I do pagan things. I do pagan ceremonies, pagan. And so, but that all is, I mean, I see religion essentially as created by human beings. And I don't mean that in a, I don't mean to say that there is no God, or I don't mean it like that. What I mean is that religion does not exist apart from the human beings that put it into action, that, you know, that believe it, that take action on it, that deploy it, that employ it, that interpret it. And so, so I see. You know, and if you study, I mean, I didn't know this obviously as a believing Mormon, but part of the nail in the coffin of my belief was studying, getting a master's degree and then a PhD in religious studies, studying the history of religion in America, and seeing that Joseph Smith may have been an innovator, but he essentially, as Catherine Albanese puts it, he was a brilliant combinative force. He combined things that were already existing and created what he did out of it. And, you know, like the word of wisdom, I remember being told at church and truly believing for many years that the word of wisdom was a mark of his, was a sign of his prophetic, you know. Well, guess what? In school, I learned that everybody and their dog had a health code back when he was running around. So that wasn't innovative. Everybody else was doing it too. So, you know, he just had the one that he had. He developed the one that he had. And it could have been revelation. I'm not saying it wasn't, but it wasn't unique. It wasn't a sign of, you know, his being special in any way, because other people were doing that. Other groups were doing that. And so I see religion as being constructed. Certainly, I see contemporary paganism as being constructed. You know, there probably are people who are hereditary witches whose parents are from Italy or, you know, wherever, from places in Europe, from the UK, who taught them, you know, their family practices of magic. But for the most part, the matriarchal myth and this hereditary story is interesting and compelling, but it's not necessarily a true story. It's a myth, like the other myths that we operate outside of. And so that was my problem, that I couldn't find, even though I felt perfectly happy in my in the kind of reincarnation I believed in at the time, which, by the way, is still the same. I still love Robin Williams. It's what dreams may come. I'm still committed to that one because I have no way of knowing, so I just choose that one. And I finally now again feel like I can find some sort of comfort in that, though, interestingly enough, I can't watch the film anymore. But the pain of that, I have a Astrid's thumbprint on this thing that I, you know, wear around my neck constantly. I got massages. I still get one every week. And I'm fortunate that I can do that. As the DSM-5 says, I stringently tried to avoid. Excuse me. I tried desperately to avoid thinking about the pain or, you know, experiencing the pain. I tried to get away from it as fast as I could because it was just so consuming. It was so awful. Even though we knew Astrid had been sick for 10 years, and we knew that she was weakening, and I talked to her that day, and she'd said that she was suffering so much she just wished she could die. And she'd said that before, and I said, oh, honey, I'll see you tomorrow. I'd flown in. We were living in California, and I'd flown in for a faculty meeting, and I never saw her again. And so it's the unspoken things, it's the things you regret, and those are normal. Those are normal things, but they're so overwhelming. They're just, and you don't know whether to say, now I say, oh, I have 5 children. No, wait a minute, I don't have 5 children anymore, I have 4. And people will say, oh, but you still have 5 children. I'm like, no, I don't. No, I don't. I had 5, now I have 4. I don't know what to say to people.
I wanted to add to that. One of the other things I did is I make sure that I'm not at home on the anniversary of Brian's death. And so, I mean, I could still go to Catalina with my students, but I've taken my family on various trips to get away from. And I recommend that highly, to not be in the place. But what Alice in my ward... always sent me cards. About once a month, she would send me a card for a year. And then just last January, her husband passed away. And as I went through the line, Alice is a very sweet, traditional, strong LDS woman. But she looks at me and she whispers, if I hear one more person talking about the plan of salvation, I'm going to barf.
Face emoji.
Yeah, and I could tell Alice had it. Well, then it was another week or two. I was talking to Alice about, I'd given her a card. I'm carrying on that tradition that her, and she thanked me, and I said, yeah, that. And a neighbor came by and said, how you doing? And Alice tears up. I mean, gollies, of course she's going to tear up. And Florence is going, oh, I'm sorry, you know. Well, not more than a month later, Florence comes up to Alice and says, well, it looks like you're doing a lot better now. And she left, and I said to Alice, next time, do you want me to take her out before she says anything? Honestly, when my dad died and we're in the funeral line, a person came by and said to my dad, when my mother died, and Dad's standing there, thanks for coming, she said to my dad, well, that makes you the most eligible bachelor around now, doesn't it? You know, I think we could write books of stupid things to say. Yeah. All right, back to questions.
Actually, I wanted to say, I just remembered now what I was telling you. I was telling you that I have tons of books about near-death experiences and life between life and things like that. Michael, what's his name? I can't remember. Anyway, all these, because I'd gathered all these to write my dissertation, because I was comparing, you know, I was talking, writing about near-death experience, but I didn't really care about the stories. I skipped. I was reading the theory. I was reading the, you know, I wanted to be able to talk about it, but I didn't care about the stories. After Astrid died, one of the first things I did was go with Holly Welker to Barnes & Noble, and I bought every single book on the ones that I didn't already have. I bought all of these books on near-death experience, on psychic stuff. I went to see James von Prague, who's absolutely precious. Just to be in the room with him is worth the price of admission. He's hysterical. But yeah, I just was desperate. I want somebody to tell me my daughter's there. I want somebody to tell me that she still exists somewhere. And all of the pagan books I had were about, you know, it's very romantic, the Summerland, but most of them had to do with the idea that you would become part of the universe, you would become part of the rocks. And they were like, that's not comforting. That doesn't help me any. That doesn't comfort me. I want somebody to tell me she's there, that she is Astrid. You know, that she still is who she is.
Things, Anne asked, things that comforted me or helped me. Mostly it was just sitting there quietly, letting me rant or rave or not judging. I mean, the Relief Society president was absolutely incredible as I was, I could be a sailor. And she just let me. I think there are no pithy, wonderful things to say. It sucks, and it's. For instance, I can handle everything really well until somebody comes and says, "How are you doing?" And that bit of tenderness will wipe me out. But yeah, I think just being there, recognizing, you're not my sister-in-law who doesn't even acknowledge a week before that I'd buried my son. You know, acknowledge the person's loss, at least.
For me, just an example is one of my students, who, and I teach online, so this is not someone I'd ever seen at all. We're now good friends, and she actually lives like a few blocks from me. It's so funny. But she showed up at Astrid's memorial right before the burial, so just, a few days after she died. She showed up and left me a beautiful book, one that I already had, but that was fine. It's I can't remember the name of it, but The Next Place, I think it's called. It's this beautiful children's book, picture book. And she signed her name to it, and I didn't even know she'd been there until a week later or 2 weeks later when I looked at the book and saw her name in there. I had no idea. She didn't approach me. She just let me be. But she did that thing for me, and it was really precious to me that she came, and that she brought me that book. But she didn't impose herself on me.
Alan?
Can I just say one or two things? I had a daughter who died at age 27 about a dozen years ago, leaving two little girls, age 3 and 1.5. And it was 10 days between diagnosis of a brain tumor and buying a casket. And a lot of the things that go through your mind, I have to tell you, my father's a funeral director, and I used to work at the mortuary, so death is not something that's foreign to my experience. But this was different. The questions that first come to your mind are, why did this happen to a perfectly normal, loving mother of two little girls? And I heard every possible cliche you can have heard, like, oh, the Lord wanted her somewhere else. It was more important that she be there. And my response was, more important that she be somewhere else than raising two little girls that she loved? I don't think so. Or it was in God's plan. Well, I thought God's plan was for mothers to raise children and for parents not to have to bury children. And finally, what gave me some peace of mind is the knowledge that we're put in the middle of a world that runs on probabilities. Some things will happen. Everybody knows that you don't win the publisher sweepstake award, but somebody wins it. Everybody knows that 27-year-old mothers don't get cancer, but the odds are that somebody will. And Giselle just happened to be that someone. You know, the ancient Greeks used to believe that immortality was measured by the number of people who remembered your name. Giselle's father, the girl's father, remarried, and they make a great effort to make sure that those two girls know who their mother was and what she was like. And so, in my mind, Giselle still lives in the hearts of those girls. And so none of those horrible cliches really matters, because for all intents and purposes, that memory of their mother will be alive forever in those girls and their kids. It was not a great experience. It was difficult. It was made worse by the fact that I had been recently divorced, and when I called my daughter after the diagnosis, and she lived in Kansas, and said, "Giselle, we'd like to come out." And she said, "Dad, Mom is here, and she'd make such a big fuss. It would be harder for me if you came than if you didn't come until after the surgery." And so it was that I never saw her alive again. When we finally got out there, she was unconscious and basically near death. What did I miss? A lot. But I can tell you, those for whom the memory is near and intense, things get better with time. The girl's father has remarried. He married a wonderful woman who has been a wonderful mother, a great mother to those girls. Will Giselle, is there anybody who can take their place? No, that doesn't happen. But the wounds heal. The scar stays, but the wounds heal and the pain isn't as intense. You can stir it up, but it gets softer. And you lose the hard edges of memory, and basically only the good remains. So that's what we want to hope for ourselves in that situation and for others in that situation. So when somebody comes up that you know who's in that situation, the best thing you can do, as Reva Beth suggests, is be there. Have somebody say, "I'm sorry for your loss." What else could they possibly say that's meaningful? And what could they possibly say that's more meaningful than that? So if you know somebody in that situation, stand with them, sit with them. Just be sympathetic. That's the best you can do. If you've suffered a similar loss, say so. Say, "When this happened to me, here's how I felt, and here's where I've been since then." Thanks.
We have 5 minutes left, and Patrick, is that you? Okay. We are required to close on time. And it's recorded, so they do shut off the recording on time. So, Patrick, I would be allowed to give you 5 minutes.
The mic is live over there if you want to stand.
I don't think I can say my name.
Okay, but you have 5 minutes, and then I'll have to go ahead and close, okay?
About a little over three years ago. A little over 3 years ago, I had a dream. And I'm not saying it was anything more than just a dream, but it shook me up. I was in a graveyard, standing next to a coffin that contained the body of my 27-year-old daughter. And I woke up shaking and in a sweat. I had never had anything shake me up like that. I knew I couldn't go back to sleep. I went out and I sat in the living room and waited for the sun to come up. Now, my daughter has always been a very independent little soul. And when I say little, I mean little. She was 5 foot, 90 pounds. And that's probably pushing it a little. But she was literally the toughest person, mentally and physically, or mentally and emotionally, I've ever known. But I called her on the phone later that day, and I was angry. And I said, I don't know what you're doing with your life. I don't know if it's the cigarettes, because she was trying to stop smoking. I don't know if it's a drug you're taking. But you're doing something that's putting your life in danger, and it better stop. I said, you're going to bury me. I'm not going to bury you. That's not the way it's supposed to work. The child buries the parents. The parents don't bury the child. And my daughter was uncharacteristically sweet and understanding about it. And she said, Dad, don't worry. I'm doing okay. And I know the only reason you're mad at me is because you love me. And she was right. 3 weeks later, I was standing in the graveyard next to a coffin that contained the body of my 27-year-old daughter. You hear people say, they talk about closure. I've heard a lot of people talk about closure. You got to get closure. I've had some experience with death. And I'm talking about the death of young people. I don't believe that closure even exists. There's no such thing. The best you can hope for in life is to figure out a way for you to personally bear the sorrow of what you're feeling. You have to make yourself and put yourself in a position that suits you, because it never goes away. But hopefully the time comes when you can breathe again. Now, I had a whole thing about how I managed to do that with my daughter. And since you have to close on time, I won't go into it. There are people who would say that my daughter's life was a waste. I mean, she was 27 years old. She never got married. She never had kids. She never finished college. And to them, I sit there and I think, I'm glad they don't say that to my face, because if they did, we wouldn't be friends very long. I'm able to find room to breathe when I realized that my daughter was not just fiery, but there was a side of her that was dedicated to helping others. And during about a 4-year period, that came out. Right before she died, she is the only girl, and she's stuck in the middle of 5 brothers. Her 3 youngest brothers are all big, strong, powerful, athletic. She's 5 foot. But I told her, I said, you know I brag a lot about your brothers and what they accomplish in sports. I know I can be obnoxious. And somebody really ought to slap the living crap out of me. But I want you to know that I have never been prouder of another human being in my entire life than I am of you. And I'm glad I said that, because that would have been my last chance. The next day, I took her up to the airport. She put her arms around me, and she said, "I love my daddy." That's how she always called. I was her daddy. "I love my daddy." And then she turned and she disappeared into the confusion of airport security, and that was the last time I ever saw her. But I'm able to breathe and I'm able to live because I understand what her life meant. She spent a life of service. And I'm proud of that. And I can live with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. I'm glad you got here to share some of your thoughts. I'm glad you got here in time to share some of your thoughts. And I do agree that the grieving doesn't end. You just find a way to breathe and live with it. And I'd like to thank all of those who attended today, and thank those who were willing to be courageous enough to actually be on this panel, because this was quite a big leap of faith to ask you to be willing to share these stories. So I want to thank you very much for being willing to do this. Thank you.